Welcome to Commonplaces, a podcast of Protestant resourcement. Commonplaces is brought to you by the Davenant Trust, where we are committed to the recovery of Christian wisdom for the church today. I'm David Cooper, the host of the conversation, and in this episode, I have a very edifying conversation with Pastor Ben Miller of Trinity Church, Long Island. Pastor Ben tells me about his journey into ministry and how he uses historical and systematic theology in his day-to-day work as a pastor. I think you'll quickly see that Pastor Ben has a humble leadership style and can teach us all to be better listeners. Pastor Ben Miller, welcome to Commonplaces.
First off, I want to ask you about your calling into the ministry. I see in your bio that you graduated law school in 99 and were a lawyer in California. Was that what caused your career change into ministry?
Yeah, I had wanted to be a lawyer actually for since I was in high school, and then I got all the way through law school and was sitting for my bar exam, and already by that time I was really kind of I guess you could say struggling with whether the Lord would want me to go into the ministry. The reasons for that are just that I had grown up in a really difficult church situation. It was really kind of a mess in retrospect. And I just saw a lot of damage to people's lives because of bad theology, and church leadership was able to control people because they didn't really maybe have a lot of sound theology to kind of protect them. And so I just really had a tremendous burden to teach people the Bible and teach them truth, and I just never could get away from that. And so once I was out of law school, that burden was just really on my heart in a very big way, and then God just kind of led me to some pastors who helped me sort through what I now would label a call to the ministry. And
And was that in an OPC context, in a Presbyterian Reformed context, that your pastors...
No, actually,
With you?
I mean, I was not in an OPC at the time at all. In fact, I had never been in a Reformed or Presbyterian church, but the Lord led me to an OPC pastor on Long Island. Kind of a long, strange story, but his name was Bill Shishko, and he just answered some of my questions and began what would become a very long and wonderful mentorship, actually, and he's the one who kind of gave me some thoughts about seminary and gave me some suggestions on where to go, and one thing kind of led to another. So he was hugely instrumental.
Okay, and that was about 10 years ago, mid-2000s?
That was the year 2000. I was in seminary by August 2001.
Oh, okay, 2001. Okay, and then at that point, were you sort of committed to the Reformed Presbyterian way of reading the Bible and seeing the world, or was that something that happened more at Greenville Seminary?
I was not a Presbyterian when I went to seminary. I think in retrospect, I was certainly sympathetic to Reformed ideas, and it was in my first semester there, in my introduction to Reformed theology class, that I suddenly began to wrestle with the covenant, and baptism and the sacraments, and just lights began to go on, and by the time I wrapped up for winter term, I was a Presbyterian.
Okay, nice. Okay. And then how quickly after graduation did you take a call on the OPC?
Right away. I graduated in May 2005. By June, I was already in an internship at the OPC in Franklin Square, where Pastor Shishko was the lead pastor, and 6 months later, they called me as their associate. So,
wonderful. Okay. And so, in seminary, as you're being introduced to the Reformed world and these 16th and 17th century figures, what drew you to them, the way that they think and the way that they view the world?
Well, I had been reading the Puritans before I even went into seminary. They were pretty formative in my coming to the Reformed, at least sort of Calvinistic ideas and later Reformed ideas. In seminary, of course, I just had a chance to begin to study them a little more systematically and in a more focused way. I mean, I began to discover the Reformers and actually the ancient church. Just so much church history I had never ever learned. I discovered there was a lot more to the Reformation than even just Calvin and Luther or the Puritans, which were kind of my entry point. And I just began to discover a whole world of thinking, not just about salvation, strictly speaking, but society and philosophy and just ecclesiology, so many things I'd never really thought much about. And so, and I've actually done even more reading after seminary. In some ways, seminary is a good place to get introductions, but I've just done so much more reading since, and it's just been wonderful.
So how do you do that? How do you choose who you're going to read and who you're going to devote time to? And do you just kind of follow rabbit trails, whatever leads you somewhere? Or are you more of a systematic, you're going to work your way through different thinkers?
I wish
thinkers?
I were more systematic. I aspire to be systematic. I have done a few systematic projects. I read through, for example, Herman Bavinck's 4-volume Reformed Dogmatics because I knew I needed to sit and read an entire Dogmatics. But in the busyness of everyday pastoral life, as you yourself know, I find myself doing a lot of reading that's related to something I'm getting ready to preach or teach about. But I always try to have a bunch of books that I'm reading on the side. Not all of them necessarily historical theology, but I always try to have a pretty strong historical thread running through my reading. Even some biographical stuff. Like I read through Bruce Gordon's biography of John Calvin not too long ago, and that was really illuminating. But I found that breadth of reading is important, and it's actually been through Davenant Trust and the Calvinist International that I've discovered so many figures and writings I didn't even know existed even in seminary. So that's, I must say, I'm very thankful for that.
And when did you discover the Calvinist International or the Davenant Trust sort of world of scholars? And
yeah, I met some of the early players from the Calvinist International at a conference in 2011, and I think it was the following spring that they very kindly invited me to join the some of their email discussions. And my word, what an education that has been! Just so many issues and ideas that I knew nothing about that I've been introduced to through these men. And, they've helped me with my reading list. I try to have a group of people that I know and listen to that are readers even more avidly than I am, and I just kind of write down all their suggested titles and try to get to them as soon as possible. So,
and so, so I'm curious then about the process of sifting through that then. I mean, we can't possibly read everything.
Right.
So how do you make judgments? How do you kind of prioritize for yourself?
Well, one thing I've learned to do is to ask people who are knowledgeable in a field what are the most important works to read. I have discovered, that there are endless books being written, many of which seem really very exciting and attractive. But there are certain works historically that are really keys. They're kind of pivotal works that others have built on, and that's true also in contemporary theology. There are certain writers and certain movements that as I talk to people who know, I begin to figure out, okay, if this is a seminal work, you really need to have this in hand. And then there's a lot of other kind of riffs maybe on it that you can get to if you have time. And I just try to listen to people who know and make sure I'm reading the stuff that's essential. It's more art than science sometimes, but
so can you share a couple over the that's 5 years ago, a couple that have influenced you and your thinking, your preaching,
particular authors,
or periods of time? You mentioned Calvin's biography or Bavinck.
Well,
as someone that
Bavinck has been without question the systematic theologian who's most shaped my theology. I would say before him, I was very, very heavily into Gerhardus Voss in seminary, which really gave me a doorway into biblical theology, which was really helpful. So I guess I'm quite indebted to the Dutch, in short. Now I find myself trying to actually get into some people that are working with Aquinas. I'm a little humbled to admit that I have tried to read Aquinas straight up and find it a little bit difficult to maybe appreciate why he says some of the things he does. And so some of his interpreters have been very helpful to me. But getting into some of the medieval theologians now has been very enriching for me.
That's great. And so how do you take that, you know, studying someone from the Reformation or even Bobbing systematics, how do you translate it as a pastor, you know, into the pulpit, into the lives of your congregants?
That is a great question. A lot of the people that I have ministered to, like myself, have come from a background that I would guess I would describe as somewhat anti-intellectual in this sense. There's a little bit of a suspicion of philosophy and even theology that is not obviously grounded in the Bible. And I think that that's actually not a bad impulse. I've been thankful for the biblicism of my past. But what I've been had to do with a lot of my preaching and teaching is number one, just help people understand, as I've come to understand, that the Bible itself assumes historical theology. It assumes a handing down of truth from generation to generation and a reasoning together about the things of God over the course of generations, and that actually we are really, really impoverished in the modern church without the voice of our forefathers, among whom the Holy Spirit has been working as surely as he's working in our generation. And so I think as I've been kind of helping set that stage, that the Bible itself insists really on historical theology and philosophy, that has made, you know, people comfortable that, okay, this is good stuff and we need to sift it, you know, not just swallow everything we read, but we need historical theology. And then if I mention from the pulpit or in teaching a particular writer, whether in the past or in the present, there's not sort of a worry that maybe we're listening to men instead of to God now or anything like that. We actually go through a lot of books in our Sunday school class. We just go through the book and talk about the ideas and kind of interact with them, and that's been very enriching. So,
can you think of a couple of titles off the top of your head over the last, you know, year or two that you guys have done in your church? Anything come to mind that was especially helpful?
Well, to give an example, we went through a book by a woman named Christine Pohl called Living Into Community. And it's interesting, and I've also been taking our folks through Rebecca DeYoung's Glittering Vices. And both of those books, interestingly, though they are written by contemporary authors, explore in some detail fairly ancient Christian thinking about virtue and vice and how virtue and vice affects church community and any human community. And that has just, we have had extraordinarily delightful and convicting and helpful discussions together about these writers as they've kind of channeled some of those ancient Christian truths, and especially in the realm of ethics. And so that'd be a couple of examples, I guess, particularly in our small group studies or Sunday school classes that we've really found profitable.
Mm-hmm. So what's the key on growing in virtue and putting and mortification of vice?
Well, I think, number one, knowing you need it. And I think that, again, is something that applies not just in our general piety, but particularly as we approach historical theology, just a listening ear. You know, whether that's the fear of the Lord that just has an open ear to God, you know, Lord, teach me, I need to change, or whether we're listening to our fathers, biological or ecclesiastical, just listening to the wisdom of others. Not that we swallow everything, but just having that sense, I need so much wisdom I don't have. I need so much graces and gifts I don't have. I think that not only is essential to community life in the present, it's part of our communion with the historical church.
That seems like a hard message for people today. I mean, I think maybe that's the case in all times and places where people don't want to listen to others, but that seems especially challenging, you know, modern day on Long Island.
And yeah.
So is it about, as a leader, modeling that, or what has enabled your community, your church, to be able to do that?
That's a really great question. Well, as far as modeling goes, I think just from my folks, maybe they would be able to answer this better than I, but I think that, number one, they know that I'm reading all the time. I'm pretty open about the fact that I've always got 20 or 30 books at any given moment that I'm wading through, and they know that, and they know that I'm constantly just trying to learn. And I think they're seeing that I know I need to learn, like, all the time. That didn't stop after seminary, and it certainly will never stop this side of glory. So, and the other thing I've found, too, is just being a pastor who listens to my people, really listens to them. I'm still learning how to do that, but just if we believe that the Holy Spirit really is in every believer and that he's working, Christ has gifted every believer for the good of the church, then I think as a leader I need to have that open ear where I'm learning from my people, even as I hope they're learning from me, and trying to create a culture of conversation where all the time I'm receiving their gifts, and I try to, you know, really make it clear that I see their gifts as gifts, and I need them, and I receive them with thanksgiving. And I think that is part of what I've tried to work on in our leadership culture to help all of us become just better listeners.
Wow. Yeah, that's very helpful. Yeah, makes me just think about how to inculcate that in my own life. Just to I think there's a sense in which parishioners want to feel that they're exercising their spiritual gifts in church, and that they are a value in the community. And so I think sometimes as a leader, that can be challenging to communicate that. I don't know if you've felt that at all.
I think, let's be honest, maybe it's a little bit like family dynamics. You know, I have four children, and there are times when, quite honestly, it is convenient for my children just to sit quietly and do as they're told. And I'm obviously they're children, I'm teaching them to be obedient, but sometimes they have ideas that are just kind of disruptive. They've got all sorts of things they're into that make a mess and wouldn't be my way of doing things or whatever. And I think in our community life too, it's easy as a leader sometimes to want people just to kind of follow an agenda that you've set. And maybe part of our deafness to history in the modern times is just a kind of wanting to remain comfortable. And I think that in contemporary relationships, we can really push back against that to say, you know, your ideas kind of jar me sometimes, or your way of doing things isn't how I would do things, or maybe as a leader, I'd be much more comfortable if people would just kind of fall in line. But I think that modeling the kind of humility that can say, hey, you know what, that's a great idea, let's go with it. It might seem kind of like a long distance from historical theology, but I think it's actually part of a culture that says, you know, when God sort of drops a bomb on the playground of our thinking through one of our forefathers in the faith, that's something to be welcomed. We need that kind of disruption to grow.
Yeah. Wow. Can you think of, would you be willing to share, or can you think of any examples in the last year or two where there has been some kind of disruption in your life where you've had to change course, either in church or...
Well, yes. I mean, to give a fairly personal example, about a year and a half ago, I had a pretty serious health breakdown due to some overwork. And my elders basically sat me down and said, we are putting you on sabbatical. And that was absolutely not in my plans at all. And I had to kind of swallow hard to submit to that direction and actually embrace it and experience the goodness of the Lord to me, the mercy of God to me in it. And it was interesting watching the people in the congregation, the way that that affected their view of the elders, that it really made them respect the elders. And I think it actually made them appreciate me maybe even more as a pastor, that they realized I'm a man who is listening to my elders. And again, I think that's just... whether as a husband or a father or as a pastor or an elder or whatever, George Grant one time said, education is simply repenting in front of other people who need to repent. Something like that. And that so many times that struck me in various roles of kind of leading or guiding the flock. If I'm not listening and submissive first to God, then to our forefathers and those I'm accountable to, you know... If I'm not following, it's going to be pretty tough for people to hear me say, you need to follow me as I follow Christ, or you need to follow Christ. I mean, they need to see that modeled.
Yeah. Yeah. So how long did that last? How long was your sabbatical?
They put me on about a 3.5-month sabbatical, and would never, ever have chosen it on my own, but I'm very thankful for it. And it that actually gave me some time to do some pretty heavy reading, which I discovered how useful that can be in the pastoral ministry, just having actual set-aside time to read when you're not racing through it to try to get ready for the next teaching responsibility. You just have time to kind of read until you're done reading and just kind of soak in things. I would highly recommend that kind of study leave for any Christian, but especially for pastors.
Yeah. So, how often do you preach on a weekly basis?
Well, I confess I have it easy. I preach once a week on Sunday. We have one service. I shouldn't say that.
I don't think that's
easy. There's some guys out there saying I didn't appreciate that remark at all. I guess compared to guys that I know are preaching, you know, two services and doing, you know, a lot more preaching than I am, I feel like I have actually a lighter load.
Yeah. So tell me about, how do you organize your week around that? When do you start preparation for, when do you have your Sabbath? Do you take a day off? Or how do you kind of structure your week?
Well, I'm trying to be a little more disciplined about this. Basically, by Sunday night, I'm obviously, you know, usually kind of, the adrenaline's wearing off, and so Monday for me is an administrative day. I try to do a lot of just paperwork and, you know, emails and stuff I need to do like that. And then Tuesday is my big initial sermon day, and I've been thinking about usually a sermon for a while, but I really sit down and try to make sure I've got a solid outline by that night. Wednesday, I try to take a midweek day off with varying degrees of success. Thursday, I'm really back to the sermon. Friday is kind of getting ready for other teaching responsibilities and cleaning up administrative stuff. And then, you know, Saturday is getting ready for Sunday. That's the general flow. I would like to see more devoted time for just prayer, really kind of withdrawing for prayer and actually for more focused reading that's kind of not directly related to a teaching responsibility. But those are things I'm still working on.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds... That's very challenging in our age to unplug a little bit, I think.
Very much so. Oh, my. Yeah. I mean, the whole discussion of how the digital age has changed Christian contemplation and reading and study and attentiveness to history and all that, that's a big topic.
What are you preaching through right now?
I'm preaching through 1 Corinthians, about probably 3/4 of the way through it. So,
and on a normal Sunday, would it be half a chapter, or are you a couple verses in a sermon? What's kind of the normal...
Well, I was originally of the mind that long expository series were a good idea, so I would take fairly small chunks of a book at a time. I guess in that sense, I really was a Puritan. Tim Keller has kind of inspired me with the idea that I still believe very strongly in expository preaching, but I think larger, to try to get through, have shorter series and try to get through more at a time. So I try to take about a chapter per sermon, although sometimes you run into a text where you realize I just need to stop and talk about this. When we got to chapter 7, it was right around the time the Obergefell decision came down, same-sex marriage decision, and I took maybe 3 or 4 weeks to preach on gender and sexuality and marriage and so on, because it just was so obviously time to do that. So I think the flexibility to do that is important.
Sure. Yeah. And so when you take on a, you know, present topic like that, how much are you bringing in, you know, ancient church voices? Are you sticking mainly just to what Paul says in chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians, or are you kind of blending the two?
Well, I always like to have Calvin at hand as a commentator. I have not used, and actually someone told me recently I need to probably change this, I haven't used a lot of ancient commentaries. I tend to work with a few very thorough modern commentaries, assuming that they will kind of distill the best of historical thought. But unfortunately, a lot of maybe modern commentaries aren't digging into the historical sources quite so much. So that's been a challenge for me to figure out how you get back and read, you know, Hodge or Calvin or maybe the Puritans on a given book or something like that. Those don't tend to show up in modern commentaries, and so you almost have to go looking for them, and I'm still learning how to do that well. And I really try not to do a lot of long quotations or even necessarily mentioning names in the pulpit. What I really try to do is make sure my people are getting stuff that is reflective of historical theology. I want them to have the conceptual apparatus of historical theology, even if they don't necessarily have all the buzzwords or, you know, think and speak and 17th century English or anything like that.
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And so you find yourself very much in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, you know, context. It's in your email. It's on your, in your Gmail. So, where do you see the OPC right now as far as speaking to the culture, as far as bringing voices from the past into the present? Can you give me a sense of the flavor now, how that's going?
I think the OPC really strives to be a historically sensitive and informed denomination. I mean, we're working with the Westminsterian tradition self-consciously. I also think that, speaking candidly, that the OPC has tended to rely quite a bit on a lot of the thinking of early, very learned men in the OPC who, you know, you think of Machen and Murray and Van Til and others, Stonehouse and others. And I think that sometimes maybe our default, and I suppose this is natural, I suppose most denominations have this, is to kind of go to our guys. I think we have to maybe work a little bit to push past the last 100 years of our own history and make sure we're listening to those voices in conversation with other voices that predate them. I also am not sure that... I think we have a lot of growing we can continue to do in just speaking to the issues of our time, speaking in language that modern people can understand and connect to. I think most of us in conservative Reformed churches probably maybe struggle with that a little bit. At least that's been my experience. So that's something I'm trying to learn.
And I mean, I think that's a challenge for sort of what the mission of the Davenant Trust is, right? I mean, it says recovering Christian wisdom for the modern age.
Yes.
But it's a long bridge to get someone to, you know, Zanke or
or even Calvin.
Or even Calvin. Yeah. And so, you any advice on the approach with someone maybe who's new to the faith or just getting into Reformed theology? How do they start to get a taste for it without, kind of trying to drink out of the fire hose?
That's a great, great question. Well, believe it or not, I've actually found... This might sound a little bit snobbish, but I've actually found John Calvin to be a great place to start. His institutes, for example, are remarkably accessible and pastoral all these centuries later. I think someone who's serious about theology could easily, you know, start with Calvin, and that'd be a great place. Or maybe his commentaries, if his institutes are too dense at first. But the other thing is, we are living in an age of just amazing riches of people who have translated the Reformers, by which I mean they're taking reformational thought and speaking it in 21st century language. One thinks, for example, 50 years ago of the Banner of Truth, you know, the way that whole organization kind of just brought the Puritans back. And there's been a ton of work in other circles since to just take deeply reformational ideas and speak them to a modern audience. That's what the Calvinist International and Davenant Trust is doing. I mean, they've taken, for example, something as complex and profound as the Two Kingdoms, classic Two Kingdoms theory, and actually spoken it in a way that the modern person can read on a blog and have access to. That kind of thing is just wonderful, and it's out there now. So, start with blogs, find modern Reformed writers that are doing stuff with Reformed theology, and then just dive into some of the Reformers and give it a try.
Yeah, that's great. Are you of an opinion that we're living in sort of a post-Christian world? Do you agree with that assessment?
Well, I mean, one must always define terms. Do I think we're living in a post-Christian world? I think we are certainly living in a time where Christianity's cultural influence is not just on the wane, but is facing enormous hostility. So if that makes us post-Christian, then yes, I do. And I think we're going to have to figure out what it means to communicate our historic, traditional faith and practice, not just to an audience that might find it somewhat incomprehensible, but actually would find it distasteful or even offensive. So that is going to be something we're all going to have to work on, and I really am excited to see what Davenant is actually doing with that side of its work.
Okay. Pastor Ben, I guess my final question, which is one I kind of thought of addressing earlier, but the move from law to pastoral work, how do you think that's influenced the way that you read the scriptures or read theology?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Law school, because I was raised in a somewhat anti-intellectualistic church environment, there was actually some little bit, I'm not sure I'd quite call it suspicion, but there was some unhappiness with my going into the law. But what I discovered in law school was it taught me how to think critically. It taught me how to identify an issue and determine what rule applies to that issue and how to apply the rule to that issue, and then, you know, sort of articulate that in some sort of conclusion, what we call the IRAC method, the issue rule application conclusion method in law school. And in that, in other ways, it really kind of just taught me how to think and articulate organized thought, which obviously has served me very, very well in the ministry. But it's also, it actually taught me the value of reason, that reason doesn't need to be an enemy of the truth. Reason is a servant to the truth. And in fact, without reason, truth is sort of subject to the whims of power, and a Christian who's a thinker and who knows, has thought truth through, is able to that provides a lot of protection from false teaching, from false teachers, as well as obviously being very enriching in its own right. So I'm very thankful for my legal training. You know, it seemed like maybe a lot of education that kind of went by the boards, but it hasn't. God has really used it, certainly in my life, and I hope in the lives of those I have the privilege of serving. So,
and you kind of opened with the idea of coming out of a place where you saw a lot of false teaching and wanting to speak the truth.
Yeah.
Are you still actively doing that? I mean, are there groups that you're, I don't know, opposing, or are you trying to do that more by building up people in the truth and in the tradition of the Christian faith?
I'd say largely by building people up in the more constructive, you know, tradition. I've had situations where I've had to speak to theological errors or you know, maybe sin issues in counseling, and the ability to articulate things clearly that I learned back in law school has helped me at those times, just try to be clear and concise. But mostly it's really just trying to build people up in, you know, teach them the Bible well, teach them theology, whether or not I use particular authors' names or am, you know, quoting paragraphs from Bob Inc., you know, it's there, the historic Reformed and Christian faith. And I, you know, the more they are just sort of nourished on that and grounded in it, you know, they won't be blown about. And that's really my desire for the sheep I minister to.
That's wonderful, Pastor Ben. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure, brother. God bless.
My thanks to Pastor Ben Miller for sharing his wise perspective on theology and pastoral work. Throughout the conversation, I was struck by his great desire to honor God with his mind. As always, you're welcome to email the show at davenantpodcast@gmail.com, and you can support the show financially at davenanttrust.org. Until next time, a little more of John Ahern's rendition of Jan Schwelinck's Toccata Chromatica.